Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour, stories and articles about the American West, produced at the Recording Library of West Texas.
Hello, this is Michael, and I am reading True West Archives. Dude, Where's My Ranch? By Mark Boardman. Published 2006. Teddy Roosevelt knew what he was talking about. To appreciate properly his fine, manly qualities, the wild rough rider of the plains should be seen in his own home. There he passes his days. There he does his life work. There, when he meets death, he faces it, as he has faced many other evils, with quiet, uncomplaining fortitude. Brave, hospitable, hardy, and adventurous, he is the grim pioneer of our race. He prepares the way for the civilization from which whose face he must himself disappear. Hard and dangerous though his existence is, it has yet a wild attraction that strongly draws to it his bold, free spirit. Theodore Roosevelt, Ranch Life and the Hunting Trail, 1888. Teddy Roosevelt knew what he was talking about. In 1883, at the age of 25, he bought a couple of ranches in the Dakotas. And in 1884, after his wife and mother died on the same day, he decided to live the cowboy life full-time. T.R. was New York-born and bred, an obvious handicap for an aspiring cowhand. Physically, in spite of efforts to build up, he was still considered skinny and weak. His political enemies made fun of his high-pitched voice, and he wore glasses, for crying out loud. Roosevelt dove in with both feet, like he did with most challenges he faced over the years. He helped build cabins, bunkhouses, and corrals. He split rails. He oversaw the development of a cattle herd. He got up at 3 a.m. to start the workday, which usually included protecting the herd from predators, both animal and human. He hunted for food. He stayed in the saddle for hours on end, trailing cattle that had wandered off. He helped drive them to market. He broke horses, and he did it in the heat of summer and cold of winter. Teddy admitted that he wasn't that good at some of the tasks, but by the time he moved back to New York, his Western colleagues considered him a real cowboy. Yeah, he still wore the glasses, but he had put on about 30 pounds of muscle, gained a new sense of confidence, if that was possible, and Eastern papers even reported that his voice had gained a commanding edge. Roosevelt knew all about image, and he really played up those cowboy years to show his strength and hardiness. The papers loved it. Thomas Nast drew an 1889 cartoon of T.R. astride a bucking horse that symbolized the spoils system in New York, saying the cowboy had tamed the political bosses. For many people east of the Mississippi, Roosevelt embodied the dream of going west to find adventure. He was the American cowboy. But the future president also knew that the way of the cowboy was rapidly dying out. Settlers claimed land that had previously been open to grazing, and barbed wire helped the process. Villages and towns sprung up along the trails and railroad routes. Terrible winters in the 1880s and 90s decimated the great herds and put thousands of cowboys out of work. Some took the outlaw trail. Bill Doolin, Butch Cassidy, Kid Curry. Some went the other way, including Pat Garrett and Charlie Siringo. Others became farmers. Still, others became townspeople. For his part, Roosevelt believed it was a good and necessary change, but he also lamented the loss of something so unique to America. For the rest of his life, he spoke wistfully about those years spent as a cowboy in the Dakotas. The myth of the cowboy lived on, of course. Owen Wister's novel, The Virginian, helped create the image of the Knight of the Plains, a chivalrous and noble man who helped damsels in distress, armed with a colt and riding a pony. Dime novels, movies, and TV shows burnished the legend, And in the process, they eliminated the sweat and blood and dirt that were commonplace on the Old West ranches. In this dream world, gunfights were daily occurrences, ignoring the fact that most real cowboys usually went unarmed. All the while, behind the Hollywood glitz, real cowboys continued to run real ranch operations. The work wasn't that much different than it was when Roosevelt went to the Dakotas. Backbreaking, long, often tedious, sometimes dangerous. And just like in the 1880s, the financial rewards were limited. But for a certain kind of person, there was no other life to match it. That's still true in 2006. It's not clear just how many cowboys there are in the United States. In 2003, the Federal Bureau of Labor Statistics counted about 6,500 people engaged in support activities for animal production, a category that includes cowboys as well as farmhands that deal with hogs, chickens, sheep, goats, llamas, etc. So it's likely that there are fewer than 5,000 working cowboys in this country. Average annual pay, $19,340. Like their Old West predecessors, most are young, in their 20s. Most grew up on ranches. But unlike the old cowboys, the current generation is pretty well educated. Many have college degrees in business or animal sciences. And of course, more than a few are women. Young people like Chris Neighbors of Colorado's Sylvandale Guest Ranch, or Jesse Beckley of British Columbia's Three Bars Cattle and Guest Ranch, love their horses and riding across the western vistas. They don't like the misconception about their jobs, and they're worried that continued development threatens the ranches and cowboys and the amazing natural beauty that surrounds them. But what they do is beyond just wrangling horses or herding cattle, and they know it. Chris, Jesse, and the others are preserving the Old West at the most basic level. They live it, and they share it with the guests who stay at their ranches. They carry on a tradition and culture that has fired imaginations for 150 years, and they do it without much attention or applause. Theirs is not the West of the pulps or movies or TV. Theirs is the real deal, with all the dirt and sweat and smell. Theirs is a way of life that appeals to a certain kind of person. We worked with the Dude Ranchers Association, which is celebrating its 80th anniversary this year, and they gave us the names of some ranches with respected young ranchers. We asked some of them to answer a few questions about their lives and work, and they kindly obliged. It's a great chance for you to meet them and get a better understanding of their efforts to keep the Old West alive. We tip our hats to them. Paradise Guest Ranch, Buffalo, Wyoming. Salvador Madrigal, born Guadalajara, Mexico in 1978. Erica Madrigal, born Lewiston, Montana in 1982. If we could own a ranch anywhere in the West, someplace close to the Sheridan, Buffalo, Wyoming area. Our passion. Horses, and living a life that involves animals, the West, people, art, ranch roping, family, and old school values. We enjoy the feeling of going to bed tired every day, knowing we have worked as hard as we possibly can. We hate it when Easterners, we plead the fifth. We love it when we get to share our lives with people who would otherwise never get to experience it, and watching the sun rise from atop a good horse. My daddy always tells me, make hay while the sun shines. Three things my mama taught me. One, laughter and time heals all. Two, pie and coffee do make a good breakfast. Three, to walk tall and act as if you are in total control. Worst part of ranch life. Bucking hay and pounding fence posts. Prettiest spots on earth. Wyoming's Highland Park and Walker Prairie. The biggest threats to our Western heritage. Rising land prices and a decline of farm and ranch families actually living off of the land and teaching the Western way of life. Favorite food? Steak, did you really have to ask? The best food in the world is made by ranch wives. The smartest horse in the world is the one that even after a long day will run, kick up his heels, and have a good roll in the pasture. Words to live by. Let every man be quick to listen, slow to speak, slow to anger. James chapter 1, verse 19. Wranglers or Levi's? Depends on the day, but mostly Wranglers. Bellota Ranch, Tucson, Arizona, Stacy Clark. Born Lansing, Michigan in 1985. If I could own a ranch anywhere in the West, Sheridan, Wyoming. My passion? Horses and rodeo. I hate it when Easterners have no respect for the ranch lifestyle. I love it when I get to ride every day. My daddy always tells me, ride hard and have fun. Three things my mama taught me. One, do what you love. Two, appreciate everything. Three, keep an open mind. Worst part of ranch life? There is no worst part. The not-so-good parts make me appreciate the very good parts. Prettiest spot on earth? Anywhere when I'm on a horse. The biggest threat to our Western heritage? People who just don't understand it. Favorite food? Steak. The best food in the world is made by my papa. The smartest horse in the world is Poco Bueno. Words to live by. Do what you love and you will never work a day in your life. But remember, if everything is always good, you won't appreciate it. But if everything is always bad, you won't know what is good. So keep balance in your life. Wranglers or Levi's? Wranglers. Latigo Ranch, Kremling, Colorado. David George, born Kremling, Colorado in 1988. If I could own a ranch anywhere in the West, next door to cowboy clinician Bryant Newbert or horse whisperer Buck Brannaman. My passion, fine horsemanship, and creating pieces of gear with rawhide. I hate it when Easterners are liberals and they try to implement gun control, develop the land to suit their desires, import animal species from their natural habitat to places they don't belong, and just stick their noses where they don't belong. I love it when I get to rope, work cows, and ride a good horse with really top hands. My daddy always tells me, work as if it's all up to you, but pray as if it is all up to God. Three things my mama taught me. One, look for ways to be a gentleman. Two, you can't be in the wrong place at the wrong time if you're never in the wrong place. Three, good enough is usually not good enough. Worst parts of ranch life? Dealing with government agencies, critters that die, big mortgages. Prettiest spot on earth? Latigo Ranch, of course. The biggest threat to our Western heritage. Besides liberals, I think our biggest threat is losing sight of our heritage and our history. When we don't know how to teach the arts of our past, they quickly get lost. Favorite food? Beef and bacon. The best food in the world is made by my mother. The smartest horse in the world is the one I want. Words to live by. Love the Lord your God with all of your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. Matthew chapter 22, verse 37. Wranglers or Levi's? Definitely Wranglers. Sylvandale Ranch Guest Ranch, Loveland, Colorado. Chris Neighbors, born Bellevue, Nebraska in 1983. If I could own a ranch anywhere in the West, Colorado is nice, but I wouldn't mind Wyoming or Idaho. My passion. I love hunting and fishing, but lately I spend all my spare time trying to start a small herd of my own. I hate it when Easterners tell me how proud they are that we have running water and electricity and everything. This really happened. I love it when I get to work cattle. My daddy always tells me how proud of me he is. Three things my mama taught me. One, be careful. Two, say a prayer. Three, enjoy whatever I am doing. Worst part of ranch life? Calving in February. It's cold. Prettiest spot on earth? Can't say for sure because I haven't seen all of the earth. Prettiest spot I have seen was a fish camp at Philmont Scout Ranch in Cimarron, New Mexico. It's like the Sierra Nevada Mountains. The biggest threat to our Western heritage. Development. It seems everyone wants their house on a nice little slice of heaven, which is often someone else's ranch or farm. Favorite food? Steak. Something thick and red. The best food in the world is made by ranchers. We raise beef. The smartest horse in the world is one that works cows. Words to live by. Trust and loyalty. Wranglers or Levi's? Wranglers. Tank Verde Ranch, Tucson, Arizona. Emily Dupre. Born Tucson, Arizona in 1985. If I could own a ranch anywhere in the West, Arizona. My passion, horses. I hate it when Easterners post the trot, something out of the jolts by rising out of the saddle seat for every other stride of the horse's forelegs. I love it when I get to ride a new horse. My daddy always tells me the only horses he will ever own are the ones under the hood of his car, but he's proud of me for pursuing my dream. Three things my mama taught me. One, live for the moment. Two, do what you love, not what pays the most. Three, don't worry, things will work themselves out. Worst part of ranch life, feeding, hay allergies. Prettiest spot on earth, Tucson Desert. The biggest threat to our Western heritage, people. Favorite food, Mexican. The best food in the world is made by Sanchez. The smartest horse in the world is my shadow. He knows me better than most people I know. Words to live by, don't squat with your spurs on. Wranglers or Levi's? Wranglers, definitely. Three Bars Guest and Cattle Ranch, Cranbrook, BC, Canada. Tyler Beckley, born St. Marie's, Ohio in 1980. Jesse Beckley, born Cranbrook, BC, Canada in 1983. If we could own a ranch anywhere in the West, where we live, in the BC Rockies, we have it all here. My passion. Tyler says sail fishing, Jesse says horses. We hate it when Easterners don't travel to the West to see it firsthand. I love it when I get to, Tyler says, spend the day deep sea fishing. Jesse says go to horse shows. Our daddy always tells us, talk to people. You never know who you may learn something from. Three things our mama taught us. One, respect ourselves and others. Two, open doors for women. Three, be respectful of elders. Worst part of ranch life? Picking stalls. Prettiest spot on earth? The place you are standing, healthy and happy to be every morning. The biggest threats to our Western heritage. Global overpopulation and the constant overuse of our planet, causing more and more of our Western lands to be desecrated while feeding the world's appetite for wood, oil, and all the natural resources the West is in reach of. Favorite food? Tyler says chicken enchilada. Jesse says carne asada. The best food in the world is made by Mexicans. The smartest horse in the world is Mr. Ed. Words to live by. Treat others as you wish to be treated. Wranglers or Levi's? Wranglers. Coffee Creek Ranch, Trinity Center, California. Alicia Ryan, owner. Born Livermore, California in 1973. If I could own a ranch anywhere in the West, Coffee Creek Ranch in California. My passion? My family. I hate it when Easterners think Northern California is like Southern California. I love it when I get to hang out with my boys and take them fishing or riding. My daddy always taught me how proud he is of me. Three things my mama taught me. One, treat people with respect. Two, work hard. Three, be honest. Worst part of ranch life. Having to drive 2 hours to the city. Takeout food would be nice every once in a while. Prettiest spot on earth, Coffee Creek Ranch. The biggest threat to our Western heritage, people who are trying to stop the ranches from using Forest Service land. Favorite food, beef. Best food in the world is made by our cooks. Smartest horse in the world is Apache. Words to live by. Everything that happens to you in life happens for a reason. Wranglers or Levi's? Wranglers. White Stallion Ranch, Tucson, Arizona. Stephen True, born Tucson, Arizona in 1988. If I could own a ranch anywhere in the West, I love the location where my family's ranch is already. My passion, to one day run my family's ranch, which my grandparents started in 1965. It was homesteaded in 1936, so some buildings are 70 years old. I hate it when Easterners think we are a bunch of backward rednecks. I love it when I get to lead trail drives. My daddy always tells me that nothing is free in life. Three things my mama taught me. One, be respectful of others. Two, always do your best. Three, always tell the truth. Worst part of ranch life? Difficult guests. Prettiest spot on earth? The view of Safford and Panther Peaks as you come over Suicide Pass. The biggest threats to our Western heritage? Development. Favorite food? Our barbecue ribs and chicken. The best food in the world is made by Judy, our cook of 41 years. The smartest horse in the world is my horse, Mojito. Words to live by. The only place success comes before work is in the dictionary. Wranglers or Levi's? No question. Wranglers, of course. Hello, this is Michael, and I am reading for True West Magazine for the July-August edition, 2023. The Deadly Escape by Bob Bowes Bell. Billy the Kid versus Olinger and Bell. April 28, 1881. Against all odds. Godfrey Gauss and Sam Wortley live behind the Lincoln Courthouse. Gauss lights his pipe and leaves his room, crossing the yard toward the main building. As he walks, he hears a shot, a tussle upstairs, and somebody hurrying downstairs, and Deputy Sheriff Bell emerging from the door, running toward me. He ran right into my arms, expired the same moment, and I laid him down dead. That I was in a hurry to secure assistance, or perhaps to save myself, everybody will believe. Gauss runs around to the east side of the building. He later remembers, when I arrived at the garden gate leading to the street, in front of the courthouse, I saw the other deputy sheriff, Olinger, coming out of the hotel, the Wortley, opposite, with the other four or five county prisoners where they had taken their dinner. I called to him to come real quick. He did so, leaving his prisoners in front of the hotel. When he had come close up to me, and while standing not more than a yard apart, I told him that I was just after laying Bell dead on the ground in the yard behind. And before he could reply, he was struck by a well-directed shot fired from a window above us, and fell dead at my feet. I ran for my life to reach my room and safety. When Billy the Kid called to me, "Don't run, I wouldn't hurt you. I am alone, and master not only of the courthouse, but also of the town, for I will allow nobody to come near us." "You go," he said, "and saddle one of George Leonard's horses, and I will clear out as soon as I can have the shackles loosened from my legs." With a little prospecting pick I had thrown him through the window, he was working for at least an hour and could not accomplish more than to free one leg, and he came to the conclusion to wait a better chance, tie one shackle to his waist belt, and start out. Meanwhile, I had saddled a small skittish pony belonging to Billy Burt, as there was no other horse available, and had also, by Billy's command, tied a pair of red blankets behind the saddle. I came near forgetting to say that whilst I was busy saddling and Mr. Billy Kid trying hard to get his shackles off, my partner, Mr. Sam Wortley, appeared in the door leading from the garden where he had been at work, into the yard, and that when he saw the two sheriffs lying dead, he did not know whether to go in or retreat. But on the assurance of Billy the Kid that he would not hurt him, he went in and made generally useful. When Billy went downstairs at last, on passing the body of Bell, he said, "I'm sorry I had to kill, but couldn't help it." On passing the body of Olinger, he gave him a tip with his boot, saying, "You are not going to round me up again." We went out together where I had tied up the pony, and he told me to tell the owner of same, Billy Burt, that he would send it back the next day. I, for my part, didn't believe much in his promise. The house the kid escapes from. The large two-story building at center above and in blow-up is the Murphy Dolan store, known locally as The House, which later did duty as the Lincoln County Courthouse. Bonnie was held on the second floor, chained to the floor and guarded by Deputy J.W. Bell and Robert Olinger. Sheriff Garrett was in White Oaks to meet engagement, and tradition says he was there to buy lumber for the gallows to hang the kid. Billy turned the tables on Bell when they were returning from the privy, somewhere at bottom right in the blow-up of the photo. The kid told Bell not to run, but the deputy ran down the stairs and was shot once by Bonnie and ran out the back door and collapsed, slipping the cuff off of his small hand. At 6 o'clock on the evening of April 28th, Deputy Robert Olinger took the five other prisoners across the street to the Wortley Hotel for their dinner. He left his shotgun in Garrett's office right next to the room the kid was being held in. With Olinger gone, Billy asked Deputy J.W. Bell to take him out back to the privy. On the way back, going up the stairway, the kid slipped off one of his handcuffs. Turning in the narrow space, the kid used the cuff as a weapon, striking Bell across the head. As the deputy stumbled backwards, the kid leapt upon him and wrestled away his pistol. As the stunned Bell turned to flee, the kid shot him in the back. This is just one version of the killing of Bell. There are other theories. See below. Where did Billy get the gun? There have been numerous hypotheses as to just how the kid turned the tables on his guard, James Bell. Some theories may have been encouraged by Billy himself to protect his friends. One theory, advanced by Walter Noble Burns, is that during a card game, Billy slipped his hands off his cuffs and seized Bell's pistol, and then shot him when he tried to escape. This version was discredited by Judge Lucius Dills, whose investigation revealed that Bell's pistol was still in its holster, fully loaded, when his body was removed. Garrett's theory is that after Bell had taken the kid downstairs and out back to the privy, the kid got considerably ahead of his guard on the return. Disappearing up the staircase, Billy leaped up the steps and threw his shoulder into the door of a room where weapons and ammunition were stored. The kid grabbed a pistol, came back to the head of the stairs, and confronted Bell, who was just coming up. When Bell panicked and turned, the kid fired, realizing the guard would shout for help if he reached the door. Tradition in Lincoln has it that a pistol was planted in the outhouse by a boy Jose Aguayo, who was related to the Bacas. The youngster was a devoted admirer of William Bonney and simply carried the gun in a newspaper, a common item to carry to an outhouse, and placed it where the kid could find it. Sam Corbett, who visited Billy every day, then slipped a piece of paper in the kid's hands without being observed by the guards. It bore one word, privy, but Billy understood immediately. Hello, Bob. After the killing of Bell, the kid retrieved Olinger's shotgun and hobbled to the window, upstairs, to command a view of the Wortley Hotel across the street, where Olinger had gone to feed the prisoners. When Olinger heard the shot, he came back across the street and entered through the gate. As he approached the building, the kid leaned out the window and shot Olinger with his own 10-gauge Whitney shotgun. Tradition says that the kid gave Olinger the cryptic greeting, "Hello, Bob," but it is doubtful Billy said anything. The courthouse window. Billy was kept upstairs, shackled to the floor in the northeast room of the house. The sheriff ordered that at least one armed guard was to be with the kid at all times. A large window lit the room from the east wall. This photo was taken sometime after the turn of the last century. From this window, the kid would have been able to see the gallows as they were built. It was a view to a kill, but not the one Lincoln and all of New Mexico Territory expected. Aftermath, odds and ends. Sheriff Pat Garrett returns to Lincoln from buying lumber for the gallows to be built to hang the kid and mounts a posse to search for Bonney, but he is unsuccessful. In Santa Fe, Governor Wallace receives a one-line telegram telling of the escape, and he posts a $500 reward for the kid's capture. A month later, Wallace is appointed minister to Turkey, and he leaves New Mexico Territory. Billy Burt's spirited pain-in-the-butt pony that Bonney had borrowed during his escape came trotting back into Lincoln, just like Billy promised. However, there is some evidence it actually got away from the kid near Les Tablas, where Yoing Salazar lived. Either way, the kid was true to his word. A week or so after his escape, Bonney walks into Fort Sumner, steals another horse, and hides out at a sheep camp 35 miles east of Sumner. Tipped off by Pete Maxwell that the kid is hiding out around Fort Sumner, Garrett leaves Roswell at night, accompanied by John Poe and Kip McKinney. They ride all night and stay off the main roads. Garrett shoots down the kid in Pete Maxwell's bedroom in Fort Sumner, July 14, 1881. Hello, this is Michael. I'm reading from True West Magazine, History of the American Frontier, July-August 2023 edition. Oregon Cherries by Sherry Monahan. The Beaver State, one of the great cherry-producing areas of all the world, grows many varieties, from Bings to Royal Annes. Oregon has been known for its cherries since the 1840s, after pioneers settled the region, but the native wild cherries were small, tart, and bitter. Knowing the territory was ideal for growing fruit trees, settlers began planting apple, pear, peach, and cherry trees. Some early cherry varieties included Red Marilla, Early May, Red Carnation, May Duke, Van Skyke, and Cluster. Traditional cherries were often yellow and pale red in color until the Bing cherry arrived, which made the dark cherry market explode. In 1847, Henderson Llewelling arrived in Oregon from Iowa and planted his first orchard of cherries. His brother Seth joined him soon after, and in 1875, Seth planted a new cultivar of sweet cherry trees in his Milwaukee, Oregon orchard. According to his stepdaughter, Mrs. Herman Letting, the Bing cherry was named in honor of a Chinese workman. Bing was close to 6 feet tall, if not more. The manner in which the cherry was named after him happened thus. He and my stepfather were working the trees, every other row each. When they discovered this tree with its wonderful new cherry, someone said, "Seth, you ought to name this for yourself." I've already got one in my name, Seth said. No, I'll name this for Bing. It's a big cherry, and Bing's big. And anyway, it's in his row, so that shall be its name. In the mid to late 1800s, the Royal Anne was an all-purpose cherry and was used in three main ways. One was for fresh eating, another was for canning, but the third and primary use was in making maraschino cherries. The Medford Mail wrote, "So keen is the competition for the Royal Anne that the maraschino buyers often overbid their canneries a full cent a pound or more." One of the leading firms making the maraschino cherries was E.G. Lyons and Ross in San Francisco. In 1907, they purchased and packed 650 barrels of Oregon Royal Anne cherries at 7 cents a pound to make maraschinos. Mr. Arthur Ross also put up several barrels of cherry juice just to make cordials and soda fountain items. The Corvallis Gazette wrote, "Oregon-grown maraschino cherries have gained a worldwide reputation for size and flavor and command the highest prices in the market." By the 1900s, the popular cherry varieties planted were Royal Anne, Bing, Lambert, and Black Republicans. In 1902, the Oregon Daily Journal offered a large spread on ways to eat cherries. Recipes included cherry charlotte, water ice, tarts, and syrup, a cherry cup, and fruit salad with cherries. In addition to cooking with them, pioneers made brandy and cordials. Women wore cherry blossoms in their hair and decorated their homes with them, and many towns had parades and fairs, all to honor the cherry. Recipe: maraschino cherries. Ingredients: 1/2 cup sugar, 1/2 cup water, 1 1/2 cups cherries pitted, 1 cup maraschino liqueur. Place the sugar and water in a medium saucepan and turn to a low heat. Bring the mixture to a simmer. Cover and allow to cook for 5 minutes. Turn the heat down to low and add the cherries. Cook the cherries at a simmer for about 3 minutes until they're slightly softened. Remove from the heat and stir in the liqueur. Allow the mixture to cool completely and refrigerate until ready to use. Recipe adapted from the Lincoln County Ledger, October 1st, 1909. Ask the Marshal. Tunstall, Sabres, and the Big Die-Off by Marshall Trimble, July-August 2023 edition. Question: who was in the posse that killed John Tunstall? Neil Hathaway, Durango, Colorado. Answer: on February 18, 1878, a posse deputized by Lincoln County Sheriff William Brady went to Tunstall's ranch on the Rio Feliz to attach his cattle on a warrant that had been issued against his business partner, Alexander McSween. Finding Tunstall, his hands, and the horses gone, a sub-posse broke from the main posse and went in pursuit. This group, made up of deputies Jesse Evans, Tom Hill, Buck Morton, and Frank Baker, caught up with Tunstall a few miles from Lincoln. His hired guns, including Kid Antrim, had ridden ahead and weren't unable to help. Tunstall at first stayed with the horses, then rode away with a posse in hot pursuit. Only the deputies bore witness to what happened next. Tunstall may have surrendered, or he may have drawn his sidearm and tried to defend himself. Either way, Tunstall died instantly when hit by 2 rifle bullets, one in the chest and another that ripped through his brain. In the aftermath, Tunstall supporters claimed that he was murdered in cold blood. Supporters of the Dolan faction insisted that he had been shot down while resisting arrest by lawfully commissioned deputy sheriffs of Lincoln County. The murder of John Tunstall provided the spark that ignited the Lincoln County War. Question: were there any lengthy winters that affected the cattle industry on the Northern Plains? Bud Hack, West St. Paul, Minnesota. Answer: two harsh winters in 1886-87 and 1887-88, followed by two dry summers, killed 80 to 90% of the cattle on the plains. On January 9, 1887, a blizzard hit, covering parts of the Great Plains and more than 16 inches of snow. Winds whipped and temperatures dropped to around 50 below. Extreme cold killed humans and animals. Some people got lost near their houses and froze to death very near their front doors. The winter of 1887-88 was a repeat of the previous year. On January 12, 1888, temperatures plummeted as low as minus 40 degrees Fahrenheit, and icy winds ripped through the air at almost 60 miles per hour. In Nebraska, between 250 and 500 people perished in the whiteout. Nicknamed the Children's Blizzard, this devastating storm resulted in the deaths of many children who lost their way walking home from school. Those 2 years, known as the Big Die-Off, transformed America's agricultural industry and marked the ending of the open-range cattle business. Question: when did the U.S. cavalry stop using sabers? Joe Manriquez, Whittier, California. The military stopped issuing sabers after World War I. However, toward the end of the Civil War, when large cavalry charges became less common, many replaced their cumbersome sabers with extra revolvers. Today, some sabers are used for ceremonies, but they are a thing of the past or of westerns. Question: on a cattle drive, a trail boss would have a letter of credit. How would a store owner know that it was good, and how did he get his money? Stanley Gooch, Little Rock, Arkansas. Back then, a man's word was his bond, especially in the cattle industry. If a merchant extended credit, it was a matter of honor to pay it back. Besides, the man needing credit was more than likely to pass that way again and need it again. So beginning in 1871, Western Union introduced electronic money transfers, so it was a simple matter to wire the money when one reached his destination. Hello, this is Michael reading from the archives of True West Magazine, History of the American Frontier. Lonesome Dove Guest Ranch by Megan Starr, published July-August 2006. When the Butlers finalized the purchase, Sharon knew the Dove was a sign from heaven. So she wrote to the lawyers for the Lonesome Dove series and received written permission to use the name for the guest ranch. Sharon is often resourceful like that. As Hal says about his wife, I don't think that she's ever admitted there are only 24 hours in a day. The two got married 4 months before Hal retired from law enforcement in 1990, and groom and bride hitched their stars to starting up guest ranches. Their first enterprise was a 600-acre guest ranch, followed by a 400-acre ranch in Whitefish, Montana. In June 1998, they opened up Lonesome Dove Guest Ranch in Kalispell, specializing in trail rides, riding lessons, deep pit barbecues, of course, offering bed and breakfast accommodations. Concerts performed by local entertainers, such as Joni Harms and Bryn Hill, are offered during the summer. In the winter, guests can ride in sleighs, pulled by Hal's champion Belgian paint draft team. Hal and Sharon both share a huge love for horses. Hal has his Belgian paints, Sharon her wild Mustangs. At the ranch, Sharon hosts a rescue service for abused or abandoned horses. She also offers veterinary internships for three universities. Besides nursing her favorite animals back to health, Sharon also runs the ranch's other business, a food company. Ranch guests were always riding in, requesting Hal's dry rub spice from his famous chicken and ribs barbecue. Recognizing the market demand, Sharon traveled to trade shows to promote the spice. The company, Montana Bounty Foods, now offers 150 products in 34 states. Hal admits every once in a while Sharon turns to him with a sly smile and asks, "Do you think the food company will ever go?" I don't know about you, but if I ever get the chance to attend the Deep Pit Barbecue at the ranch, I'll be asking for some of that dry rub spice myself. True West Archives, July-August 2006 edition. From Homesteaders to Wolfers by Jana Bommersback. Her name wasn't in history books or halls of fame, and her contribution to Western history was stashed, literally, in the basement of a friend. Then, writer Donna M. Lucy came snooping around in 1978, looking for photos to illustrate a book on female pioneers. The curator of the Montana Historical Society in Helena mentioned there was a stash of glass plate negatives, but all efforts to display them had been rebuffed by the farm woman who'd inherited Cameron's estate. Thankfully, Lucy was a skilled persuader. She convinced Janet Williams to share the treasures hidden in her basement. "I was astonished by what I saw," Lucy writes in her book, Photographing Montana, 1894 to 1928. "For years, I had been traveling throughout the West, combing photo collections for Time Life Books, series on the Old West, and I had never found anything like these pictures. They presented an intimate view of pioneer life in eastern Montana, a close-up portrait of men and women who had settled one of the most remote and desolate regions of the West. As remarkable as the pictures themselves were, was the fact that the photographer, whose name was Evelyn Cameron, was almost entirely unknown, except by a few historians in Montana, none of whom had seen more than a small sampling of her work. Cameron's name appeared in no general histories of the West, nor of Western photography, but the few images I had in hand were proof that Evelyn Cameron was a master photographer of the West. Originally published in 1990 by Alfred A. Knopf, and republished in 2001 by Mountain Press Publishing of Montana, Lucy's book shares a full history of this remarkable woman who left the luxury of English society on her honeymoon to tough it out in a remote piece of the Old West. The book features about 150 photos from the 1,800 negatives Lucy found in that basement." From T. and Fox Hunts. Evelyn Battersees was born on August 26, 1868, the youngest child of an English merchant who traded in East Indian items and provided a full Victorian lifestyle for his family. There was a plush house, generous grounds, and 15 servants. Women were expected to spend their time at teas and fox hunts. Women riding Sad Saddle, of course, and were discouraged from unladylike activities, such as education and work. Little of this suited Evelyn, who in 1889 dismayed her family by marrying a Scot named Ewan Cameron. He shared her love of horse flesh and hankered to explore new lands. Apparently, Evelyn didn't look back as she enthusiastically boarded a boat for America. Indeed, the prospect of a life in a remote wilderness suited her perfectly, Lucy writes. Not only could she lead the outdoor life of riding and hunting she adored, she could also escape the scrutiny of her disapproving relations. The couple arrived in eastern Montana with an English cook and one of Custer's scouts as a guide, and settled around Miles City and Terry in a stark landscape with intense solitude. The cook was soon gone as the couple struggled to make a life. They hoped to raise polo ponies for the European market, but after many years of trying, they finally gave up. They originally lived off Evelyn's trust fund, but it wasn't enough. To help support her husband and her brother who now lived with them, Evelyn planted an acre-large garden and sold vegetables, bringing in the only cash the family saw. The garden also, of course, fed the family. Her second money-making plan, while her husband failed at his attempts to raise cattle, was to take in wealthy boarders, hoping they'd invest in the ranch, but none ever did. The couple wouldn't find any financial security until Evelyn discovered photography in 1894, basically teaching herself on a dry plate glass negative Kodak. Although the popular camera company had already progressed to a far easier Kodak model. You press the button and we do the rest. Evelyn preferred the old-fashioned method that used 5x7 plates. She charged $2 for a family portrait and traveled the countryside drumming up business. By 1902, she had a decent business going with a photographic calling card and regular customers. By September of that year, she had made $94.40 selling photographs. She also illustrated the numerous articles Ewan wrote for ornithological journals, often with no photo credit for herself. But she loved these collaborations and called them our greatest pleasure in life. As Lucy recounts, Evelyn was fascinated by what she referred to as the New World type, the colorful frontier characters who were drawn to the remote areas and by the how-to of life in the West, how to thrash a field of wheat, how to shear a sheep, how to drive a herd of cattle across the Yellowstone River. She did on-the-scene documentary photography of them all. Evelyn loved photographing homesteaders, posing in front of their meager but proud shacks, and documenting the important moments of their lives. Weddings, reunions, 4th of July celebrations. She often had them dress in their Sunday clothes. Besides families, she focused on cowboys and wolfers, solitary hunters who lived off the bounty for coyote and wolf skin, as well as her fellow female pioneers. In her photos, Lucy writes, women are seen riding, roping cattle, tending animals in gardens, cooking for sheep shearers and farm crews, and working in the wheat fields. And her diaries make clear that women were not shielded from the rigors and dangers of ranching and farming. Evelyn also wrote and illustrated magazine articles about Montana ranch women, obviously impressed with how hard Russo-German women worked in the fields. She recognized the effort because it mirrored her own. Her 35 handwritten journals, kept painstakingly for some 40 years, as well as hundreds of letters, give an amazing insight into life in those days. The overwhelming impression one is left with throughout Evelyn Cameron's diaries is the sheer physical and emotional strength that life in the frontier Montana demanded, Lucy notes. Work was never-ending and backbreaking, and there were few distractions. The diaries also have constant references to their ever-present rattlesnakes that are the demons in virtually every Western journal. One day, she actually teased a snake to go on the fight before she shot its body to smithereens. Another time, she photographed a coiled snake at close range. Most of all, Evelyn spelled out the transformation of Montana territory. Lucy notes that Evelyn's photography documented the cultivation of the prairies by the honeycockers, a derogatory term for homesteaders, while she shared the angst of cowboys and ranchers and watching the land cultivated and fenced up. As Evelyn wrote a friend in 1911, the range country that you knew so well is about gone now, and the prairie swarms with farmers who plow up the land with steam and gasoline engines. The Camerons themselves lived on Eve Ranch, actually three different sites in the same area and bearing the same name in her honor. They had three rooms, a kitchen, Brother Alex's bedroom, and the couple's bedroom and sitting room. The front door was the major gathering spot. What little rest Evelyn got was on that porch, overlooking the Yellowstone River and catching the breeze. Although she didn't complain, her diary made clear that the bulk of work fell on her shoulders, not only earning the money that kept the family going, but also doing all the gardening, cooking, and washing. When the couple went off to their frequent hunting trips, making camp as they sought out wild game to flesh out their diets, Evelyn also was in charge of camp upkeep and helped with the butchering. Ewan died in 1915, and Evelyn stayed on alone at her ranch, writing a friend that she was so active she was as busy as a one-armed man with hives. In 1918, she became a citizen and voted in that November's election. She was 60 when she died in 1928 after an appendectomy. Apparently, she knew the end was coming because she killed her favorite horse before leaving for the hospital. The church overflowed for her funeral, but then she was forgotten for a long time. That oversight of history has been corrected. Evelyn Cameron is enshrined in the National Cowboy Hall of Fame in Fort Worth, Texas, and in the Montana Historical Society in Helena, Montana. In Terry, the Prayer County Museum houses an Evelyn Cameron Gallery. Through Evelyn's photographs and her words, we have a special insight into Montana territory.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour, stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.